Peace, everyone. Hope you are doing well. I just wanted to hop on really quick today to do a little episode on something that I've been feeling kind of passionate about. I was hoping to be able to download an audio file and enter or begin this episode with it. However, I think the only way to do so is going to be either sharing a screen recording or like just putting my phone or my mic next to an audio source and playing it. But I'll probably do that afterwards, record it in multiple different ways and see what sounds best, and either upload it separately or edit the uploaded episode that we're recording now and stitch it on there once I figure out how to do so. But anyways, welcome to the show. I am your host, Josh. This is In Defense of Liberation, the show that is working towards and educating about a true people's liberation movement and also revolution. My name is Josh. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a trans woman. We talked about that actually recently in the past episode and some other things, and kind of sprinkled in there in some previous episodes to that. So if you want to hear more about my experience, my ideas, or kind of connection to the LGBTQIA community and what's going on this month with Pride, and then, all year round with the rise in violence and reactionism, I think the last episode was a good one. We're going to be treating this episode essentially like a live stream, except it's not going to be live. For folks who haven't tuned into my episodes before, they're usually pretty laid back, but we're gonna take that to a new level today because I am exhausted. So I hope this is some casual listening for folks and enjoyable for those who do tune into the show. Please share it if you like it. I would love to hear from new folks about, ways to improve, things to talk about, and maybe even invite some of you who have been listening to the show for a while on for like a little panel discussion. Maybe we could get a group chat going. I've heard from a few of you. Let me know if you're open to that. So today we're going to be talking about a few things. I'm going to start out by talking about a very important speech, which I spent the last hour and a half trying to find either a full audio clip, a full video clip, an archive from the United Nations General Assembly, an archive from Cuba, or an archive from Fidel Castro's archives. And it was the 31st plenary meeting speech on the importance of ending words and starting action would be one way I could sum up the speech. And the other is putting forward a sincere questioning of why are there those who in the world are able to own everything and accumulate massive resources in a way that humanity never has been capable of doing before, while at the same time, there are those, such as children, who do not even have a piece of bread. There are people who are condemned to be eternally poor. There are billions of people, human beings, who own nothing. And then there are those who are exploiting and taking advantage of these oppressed peoples in order to remain in power and rich. So, as I said, this was the 31st plenary session of the UN General Assembly. The speech was given on October 12th, 1979. Fidel Castro, I believe, was the first speech of the day. And we have some records here. So it was the 34th session of the General Assembly. It was an address given by Fidel Castro Ruz, President of the Council of State and the Government of the Republic of Cuba. It was presided over by the President, Mr. Salim Ahmed Salim from the United Republic of Tanzania. And it was given to what seemed to be one of the most empty crowds, though more filled than what you see nowadays of the General Assembly. For folks who don't know much about the United Nations, I'll talk more about it after reading some of the speech, but the issue, which even Fidel asks in his speech, what is the point of the United Nations? If this space, this supposed democratic space and free world assembly, right, is to be taken for granted, is to be taken at its own conclusions, and to be assumed to be the thing that we're all told it is, right? Then how is it that these issues have been able to persist and, in fact, worsen over the years? If this United Nations, the General Assembly, the internationalism, and the what's it called? The central kind of foundation piece, the charter. If this is as powerful and as meaningful as it's meant to be, as we're meant to believe it is, how is it that all of these problems, all of this suffering has been able to continue? And that's kind of the main thesis of this point, right? Of this speech. So I'm going to read some of it here. I don't know if I'm going to read all of it because it's looking like it's moderately long. But we're going to read it. We're going to see about how long it seems to take. And if I need to stop, then we can stop. And I would suggest that folks check out the links I'm going to share of the excerpts of this speech. So, this is a translation from Spanish, so my apologies. It might be somewhat inaccurate if you speak Spanish. Maybe it would be cool if you read it, because I think it actually sounds better in Spanish. But so I'm reading as Fidel here. This morning, or excuse me. I have not come to speak about Cuba. I have not come to denounce in this assembly the attacks to which our small but worthy country has been subjected for 20 years. Nor have I come to wound with unnecessary adjectives the powerful neighbor in his own house. We have been charged by the Sixth Congress of the heads of state of government of non-aligned countries to present to the United Nations the results of its deliberations and the positions to be derived therefrom. We are 95 countries from all the continents, representing the overwhelming majority of mankind. We are linked by our determination to defend the cooperation among our countries, to ensure free national and social development, sovereignty, security, equality, and self-determination. We are associated in our determination to change the present system of international relations, based as it is on injustice, inequality, and oppression. In international politics, we act as an independent world factor, meeting in Havana The non-aligned movement has just reaffirmed its principles and confirmed its objectives. The non-aligned countries stress the fact that it is imperative to do away with the enormous inequality that separates the developed from the developing countries. We are struggling to eradicate the poverty, hunger, disease, and illiteracy from which hundreds of millions of human beings still suffer. We aspire to a new world order, one based on justice, equity, and peace, one that will replace the injustice and unequal system that prevails today, in which, as proclaimed in Havana, wealth is still concentrated in the hands of a few powers whose wasteful economies are maintained by the exploitation of labor, as well as the transfer and plunder of the natural and other resources of the peoples of Africa, Asia, Latin America, and other nations of the world. Among the problems to be debated at the present session of the General Assembly, peace is at the first concern. The search for peace also constitutes an aspiration of the movement of non-aligned countries and has been the subject of the attention of the Sixth Conference. But for our countries, peace is indivisible. We want a peace that will equally benefit the large and the small, the strong and the weak, a peace that will embrace all regions of the world and reach all its citizens. Since its very inception, the movement of non-aligned countries has considered that the principle of peaceful coexistence should be the cornerstone of international relations, should constitute the basis for the strengthening of international peace and security, for the relaxation of tensions, for the expansion of that process to all regions of the world and to all aspects of international relations, and should be universally applied in relations among states. But at the same time, the Sixth Conference considered that these principles of peaceful coexistence also include the rights of peoples under alien and colonial domination to self-determination, independence, sovereignty, respect for the territorial integrity of the states, and the right of every country to put an end to foreign occupation and to the acquisition of territory by force, and to select its own social, political, and economic system. Only thus can peaceful coexistence be the foundation for all international relations. This cannot be denied. When we analyze the structure of the world today, we can see that these rights of our peoples are, as yet, not guaranteed. The non-aligned countries know full well who are our historical enemies. We know whence come the threats and how to combat them. That is why we resolved in Havana to affirm that the quintessence of the policy of non-alignment, in accordance with its original principles and essential character, involved the struggle against imperialism, colonialism, and neocolonialism, apartheid and racism, including Zionism, and all forms of foreign aggression, occupation, domination, interference, or hegemony, as well as against great power and bloc policies. Thus, it will be understood that the final declaration of Havana linked the struggle for peace with the political, moral, and material support for the national liberation movements and joint efforts to eliminate colonial domination and racial discrimination. The non-aligned countries have always attached great importance to the possibility of and the need for détente among the great powers. And thus, the Sixth Conference pointed with great concern to the fact that in the period that elapsed after the Fifth Conference held in Colombo in 1976, a certain stagnation took place in the process of détente, which has continued to be limited in both scope and geographically. On the basis of that concern, the non-aligned countries, which have made disarmament and denuclearization one of the permanent and most prominent objectives of their struggle, and which took the initiative to convene the 10th Special Session of the General Assembly on Disarmament examine the results and the negotiation on strategic arms and the agreement reached as a result of the second round of the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, SALT. They consider that those agreements constitute an important step in the negotiations between the two main nuclear powers and could open up prospects for more comprehensive negotiations leading to general disarmament and the relaxation of international tensions. Hold on. I gotta adjust the settings on my fucking computer. I'm having a hard time reading it, and I think I just need to turn down the brightness. Sorry. Okay, that is better. And let me zoom in a little. Okay. All righty. Sorry about that, folks. But those treaties, as far as the non-aligned countries are concerned, are only part of the progress towards peace. Although a negotiation between the great powers constitutes a decisive element in the process, the non-aligned countries once again reiterate that the endeavor to consolidate détente and to extend it to all parts of the world and to avert the nuclear threat, the arms buildup, and in one word, war, was a task in which all the peoples of the world should participate and exercise their responsibilities. Basing ourselves on the concept of universality of peace and the need to associate the search for peace extended to all countries with the struggle for national independence with full sovereignty and with equality among states, we, the heads of government who met at the Sixth Conference of Non-Aligned Countries in Havana, turned our attention to the most pressing problems in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and other regions of the world. It is important to stress that we started from an independent position that was not linked or tied to policies that might stem between the contradictions between the great powers. If, in spite of that approach, which was uncommitted and objective, our review of international events became an anathema hurled against the supporters of imperialism and colonialism, it merely reflects the essential reality of the world today. That's a pretty strong line. Thus, on starting the analysis of the situation of Africa, and after having recognized the progress made by the African people's struggle for their emancipation, the heads of state or government stressed, as fundamental problem of the region, the urgency of eliminating from the continent, and especially from southern Africa, all traces of colonialism, racism, racial discrimination, and apartheid. It was indispensable that we should stress the fact that the colonialist and imperialist powers were continuing their aggressive positions with the aim of perpetuating, regaining, or extending their domination and exploitation of the African nations. And that is precisely the dramatic situation in Africa. The non-aligned countries could not fail to condemn the attacks on Mozambique or Zambia, on Angola, on Botswana, the threats against Lesotho, the destabilization efforts that are constantly being made in that area, and the role of the racist regimes of Rhodesia and South Africa. The pressing need for Zimbabwe and Namibia to be completely liberated as soon as possible is not just one of the causes of the non-aligned countries or of the most progressive forces in our era. It is laid down in resolutions and agreements adopted by the international community through the United Nations. It implies duties that cannot be shirked and the violation of which must call for international denunciation. Thus, when the heads of state or government approved the final declaration, which condemned by name a group of United or a group of Western countries headed by the United States for their direct or indirect collaboration in the maintenance of South Africa's criminal policy and racist oppression, and on the other hand, recognized the role played by the non-aligned countries, the United Nations, and the Organization of African Unity, the socialist countries and the Scandinavian countries, and other democratic and progressive forces in supporting the struggle of the peoples of Africa. It did not involve even the slightest manifestation of ideological leanings. It was simply a true expression of the objective reality. To condemn South Africa without mentioning those who make the criminal policy possible would have been incomprehensible. More forcibly and urgently than ever, the Sixth Conference expressed the need to not only end the situation in which the rights of people in Zimbabwe and Namibia to independence is denied, but also to support the urgent requirement for the black men and women of South Africa to attain a status in which they are to be considered as equal, respected human beings, and to guarantee conditions of respect and peace for all the countries in the region. Continued support for the national liberation movements, the Patriotic Front, and the Southwest African People's Organization, SWAPO, was a decision so unanimous that we could have almost foreseen it. And let us state this very clearly now. This is not a case of expressing a unilateral preference for solutions through armed struggle. It is true that the conference praised the people of Namibia and SWAPO, their sole and authentic representation for having stepped up the armed struggle and advancing it. And it requested all-out effective support for that form of combat. But that was due to the fact that the South African racists have slammed the door to any real negotiations. And the efforts to achieve negotiated solutions go no further than mere stratagems and maneuvers. The attitude towards the decisions taken at the meeting of heads of government of Commonwealth countries at Lusaka last August to have the United Kingdom government as the administering power for Southern Rhodesia call a conference to discuss the problems of Zimbabwe, confirmed by the fact that the non-aligned countries are not opposed to solutions that may be achieved without armed struggle, so long as they lead to the establishment of a real government representing the majority and the achievement of an independence that is satisfactory to the fighting peoples, and that this be done in accordance with the resolutions of such bodies as the OAU, the United Nations, and our own movement of non-aligned countries. The Sixth Conference once again had to express its regret that the General Assembly Resolution 1514-XV concerning the granting of independence to colonial countries and peoples has not been applied in Western Sahara. We should recall that the decision of the non-aligned countries and the resolutions of the United Nations, more specifically the General Assembly Resolution 33/31, have all reaffirmed the inalienable right of the people of Western Sahara to self-determination and independence. Cuba feels a special responsibility with regard to this problem, since it was a member of the United Nations visiting mission to Western Sahara, sent in 1975 to investigate the situation in the territory, which enabled our representatives to verify the total desire of the Saharan people for self-determination and independence. We repeat here that the position of the non-aligned movement is not one of antagonism towards any country. Nothing but the application of our principles and the agreements of the United Nations should be seen in our welcoming the conclusion of the agreement A34427S13503, Annex 1, between the Islamic Republic of Mauritania and the Frente Polisario, and the decision of the Republic of Mauritania to withdraw its forces from the territory of Western Sahara, as well as its deploring the extension of Morocco's armed incursion into the southern part of Western Sahara, previously administered by Mauritania. Therefore, the conference expressed its hope that the special committee established at the 16th ordinary session of the Assembly of Heads of State of the Government of the OAU would provide a guarantee that the people of Sahara would be allowed to exercise their right to self-determination and independence as soon as possible. Gonna take a little break here. Hold on. All right. That same principle and that same position determined the resolution on Mayotte and Malagasy Islands and the need for them to be reintegrated to in the Comoros and Madagascar, respectively. There can be no doubt that the problem of the Middle East has become one of the situations that gives rise to the greatest concern and worry in the world today. The Sixth Conference examined in its twofold dimension. On the one hand, the conference reaffirmed that Israel's determination to continue its policy of aggression, expansionism, and colonial settlement in the occupied territories with the support of the United Nations and the United States constitutes a serious threat to world peace and security. The conference also examined the problems from the point of view of the rights of the Arab peoples and the Palestinian peoples. For the non-aligned countries, the Palestinian question is the very crux of the problem of the Middle East. Both questions form an integral whole, and neither can be settled separately. The basis for a just peace in the region starts with the total and unconditional withdrawal of Israel from all the occupied Arab territories and provides for the return to the Palestinian people of all their occupied land. And the restoration of all their inalienable national rights, including their right to return to their homeland, to self-determination, and to the establishment of the independent state of Palestine, in accordance with the General Assembly 3236. This implies that all measures taken by Israel in the occupied Palestinian and other Arab territories, such as the establishment of colonies or settlements in Palestinian and other Arab territories, whose immediate dismantlement is the prerequisite for the solution of the problem, are all illegal, null, and void. As I stated in my inaugural address to the Sixth Conference, quote, "We are not fanatics. The revolutionary movement has always learned to hate racial discrimination and pogroms of any kind. From the bottom of my heart, we are repudiated by the merciless persecution and genocide that the Nazis once visited on the Jews. But there is nothing in recent history that parallels it more closely than the dispossession, persecution, and genocide that imperialism and Zionism are currently practicing against the Palestinian people. Pushed off their land, expelled from their own country, scattered throughout the world, persecuted and murdered, the heroic Palestinians are a vivid example of sacrifice and patriotism, living symbols of the most terrible crime of our era." Can anyone be surprised that the conference, for reasons that stemmed from not any political prejudice, but rather from an objective analysis of facts, felt called upon to note that the United States policy, in aligning itself with Israel and supporting it and working to obtain partial solutions that are favorable to Zionist aims, and to guarantee the fruits of Israel's aggression and the at the expense of Palestinian Arab peoples and the entire Arab nations, played a major role in preventing the establishment of a just and conference peace in the region? The facts, and only the facts, led the conference to condemn the policy and maneuvers of the United States in that region. When the heads of state or government arrived at the consensus which condemned the Camp David agreements and the Egyptian-Israel Treaty of March 1979, their formulations had been preceded by long hours of detailed study and fruitful exchanges, which allowed the conference to consider those treaties not only as a complete abandonment of the cause of the Arab countries, but also as an act of complicity with the continuing occupation of Arab territories. The terms are hard, but they are true and just. It is not the Egyptian people who have been subjected to the judgment of the organs of the movement of non-aligned nations. The Egyptian people command the respect of each and every one of our countries and enjoy the solidarity of all our peoples. The same voices that were raised to denounce the Camp David agreements and the Egyptian-Israeli treaty eulogized and praised Gamal Abdel Nasser, a founder of the movement and one of those who upheld the fighting traditions of the Arab nation. No one ignores, and no one will ever be unaware of Egypt's historic role in Arab culture and development, or its merits as a founding nation and a driving force in the movement of non-aligned countries. The conference also gave its attention to the problems of Southeast Asia. The growing conflicts and tensions that have been created in the region are a threat to peace and must be avoided. Similar concern was expressed by the Sixth Conference regarding the situation in the Indian Ocean. The declaration adopted 8 years ago by the General Assembly proclaiming the Indian Ocean as a zone of peace has not been fulfilled. The military presence in the region has not been reduced. It is growing. Military bases have reached as far as South Africa, are also serving as a means for surveillance of the African liberation movements. The talks between the United States and Soviet Union are still suspended despite the recent agreements between the two countries to discuss their resumption. All this led to the Sixth Conference's invitation of all states concerned to work effectively to fulfill the objective of the Declaration of the Indian Ocean as a zone of peace. Gonna pause here just to pull it out into present time and say, folks should check out the Black Alliance for Peace's discussion of the zone of peace and the reinvigoration of this movement in Haiti, Havana, and in the United States. That can be found at blackallianceforpeace.org by searching Zone of Peace. There's a couple different documents on that that folks should check out, but yeah, definitely look into that. All right, continuing. The Sixth Conference also analyzed other issues of regional and world interest, such as those touching on European security and cooperation, the problem of the Mediterranean, and the tensions that still exist there that now have been increased as a result of Israel's aggressive policy and the support given it by certain imperialist powers. The conference also studied the situation in Cyprus, an island still partially occupied by foreign troops, and Korea, which is still divided despite the Korean people's desire for peaceful reunification of their homeland. This led the non-aligned countries to reaffirm and broaden resolutions of solidarity aimed at fulfilling the aspirations of both peoples. It would be impossible to refer to all the political decisions of the Sixth Conference. If we were to do so, we would be unable to touch upon what we consider to be one of the most fundamental aspects of that conference, namely its economic projection. The clamor of the developing countries who have had enough of backwardness and of its suffering that is engendered. Cuba, as the host country, will present to all members of the international community copies of the conference's final declaration and additional resolutions. But before informing this assembly of how the non-aligned countries view the world economic situation, which demands they make and which hopes they nurture, perhaps I will be allowed to take a few minutes more to inform you of what the final declaration's approach was concerning Latin American issues at the moment. The fact that the Sixth Conference was held in Latin America allowed the heads of state or government meeting there to recall that the people of the region starting their efforts to obtain independence at the very beginning of the 19th century. They also did not forget, as is said in the declaration, that Latin America is one of the regions of the world that historically has greatly suffered from the aggressions of the United States and European imperialism, colonialism, and neocolonialism. The participants in the conference were forced to point out that in the area of struggle, remnants of colonialism, neocolonialism, and national oppression still remain. Thus, the conference spoke out in favor of the eradication of colonialism in all its forms and manifestations. It condemned the presence of foreign military bases in Latin America and the Caribbean, such as those in Cuba and Puerto Rico, and again demanded that the government of the United States and other colonial powers restore to those countries that part of their territories that is occupied by those bases against the will of the peoples concerned. The experience lived through in other areas led the heads of state to reject and condemn any attempt to create a so-called security force in the Caribbean, a neo-colonial mechanism incompatible with the sovereignty, peace, and security countries therein. So another pullout to the present time. The core group, which is currently activating yet another occupation of Haiti, and the United States' continual armament of gangs through Florida and other regions, proves this statement very true. Because even the United Nations soldiers, right, that go to these places are guilty of genocidal acts of murder, of rape, of violence. Soldiers from all countries from around the world acting upon an interest of their government to receive essentially free military training by occupation through colonial, aka neo-colonial forms set up by the United Nations. Let me take another hit here. This part, so we still got a long way to go, folks. Hope you're doing well. I know this can be kind of boring, but hopefully it's interesting to someone. This section is interesting because I don't know much about this, but I've heard a little bit about it. So continuing here. In seeking the restoration of the Malvinas Islands to the Argentine Republic and reaffirming its support for the unalienable rights of the peoples of Belize to self-determination, independence, and territorial integrity, the conference once again corroborated what its declaration had defined at the very quintessence of the policy of non-alignment. Welcome the fact that as of the 1st of October, the Panama Canal treaties between the Republic of Panama and the United States would come into force. It gave its full support to those treaties, and it called for their full observance in letter and spirit. Furthermore, it called on all the states of the world to accede to the protocol of the treaty concerning the permanent neutrality of the Panama Canal. Despite all pressures, threats, and flattery that were brought to bear, and despite the obstinacy, of the United States government in demanding that the issue of Puerto Rico be considered an internal problem of the United States, the heads of state or government reiterated their solidarity with the struggle of Puerto Rican people and their inalienable right to self-determination, independence, and territorial integrity, and called upon the government of the United States of America to refrain from any political or repressive maneuvers tending to perpetuate the colonial status of that country. No more appropriate tribute than this could be paid to Latin American traditions of freedom and to the heroic people of Puerto Rico, who in the last few days have just celebrated another anniversary of the Cry of Lares, which expressed their indomitable will for freedom over a century ago. When referring to the Latin American reality, the heads of state of government who had already analyzed the significance of the liberating process in Iran could not fail to refer to the revolutionary upheaval in Granada and the remarkable victory of the people of Nicaragua and their vanguard, the Sandinista National Liberation Front, and emphasize the enormous historic significance of that event for the peoples of Latin America and of the world. The heads of state or government also stress something new in Latin American relationships, something that sets an example to other regions of the world. Namely, the way in which the governments of Panama, Costa Rica, and Mexico, as well as the member countries of the sub-regional Andean Pact, Bolivia, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, and Venezuela, acted in unison and solidarity to achieve a just solution to the Nicaraguan problem, as well as the Cubans' tradition of solidarity with the cause of that people. I confess that these considerations on Latin America would alone have justified the Cuban people's efforts and the concern of hundreds of thousands of men and women of our country who were determined to enable Cuba worthily to welcome the fraternal nations of the movement of non-aligned countries at the Havana Conference. But for Cuba, there was much more than this. There was something which, on behalf of our people, we would like to thank this assembly for in this forum of the United Nations. In Havana, the Cuban people's right to choose their political and social system was supported, as was their claimed territory occupied by the naval base of Guantanamo. And furthermore, the unjust blockade with the United States government continues in its efforts to isolate the Cuban Revolution, seeking to destroy it, was condemned. We deeply appreciate the universal acclaim given to the 9-Aligned Movement's recent denunciation in Havana of the hostile acts, declaring them to be a flagrant violation of the Charter of the United Nations and of the principle of international law. They are also a threat to world peace. Once again, we reply to our brothers, assuring the international community that Cuba will remain true to its principles of international solidarity. History teaches us that when a people is freeing itself from colonial or neo-colonial systems, it obtains its independence, or obtaining its independence, that is at once and at the same time the last act in a lengthy struggle, in the first one in a new and arduous battle for the independent sovereignty and freedom of our peoples, who are apparently free, are constantly threatened by a foreign control over our natural resources, financial impositions by official international bodies, and by the precarious situation of our economies, all of which reduce the fullness of our sovereignty. For this reason, at the very beginning of their analysis of the world economic problems, the heads of state or government, quoted, once again solemnly emphasized the paramount importance of consolidating political independence by economic emancipation. They therefore reiterated that the existing international economic system runs against the basic interests of the developing countries. It's profoundly unjust and incompatible with the development of the non-aligned and other developing countries, nor does it contribute to the elimination of the economic and social evils that afflict these countries. Furthermore, they went on to emphasize, the historic mission that the movement of non-aligned countries should play in the struggle to obtain the economic and political independence of all developing countries and peoples, to exercise their full and permanent sovereignty and control over their natural and all other resources and economic activities, and to promote a fundamental restructuring of the world economy through the establishment of the new international economic order, in order to conclude that, quote, the struggle to eliminate the injustice of the existing international and economic system and to establish the new international economic order is an integral part of the people's struggle for political, economic, cultural, and social liberation. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit because we're looking at now. Oh, all right. Little computer difficulties here. We're looking at, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 more pages. And those 4 pages took me about 40 minutes. So what I'm going to do is read from approximately the last page and a half and close it out. And then I'm going to talk about this and something else and why I wanted to bring it up. So going back and finishing up here. The United States alone will in the 1980s spend 6 times that much more on military activities. We are requesting less for 10 years of development than is spent in a single year by the ministers of war, and much less than a tenth of what will be spent for military purposes in 10 years. Some may consider our demand irrational, but where the true irrationality lies is in the world's madness in our era and in the threats and perils which hover over mankind. The enormous responsibility of studying, organizing, and distributing these amounts of resources should be entrusted fully to the United Nations. These funds should be administered by the international community itself, on a footing of absolute equality for all countries, whether they be contributors or beneficiaries, without any political conditions and without the amount of donation having anything to do with the voting power in deciding when loans are to be granted and to whom. Even though the flow of resources should be measured in financial terms, it should not be consistent only of money. It may be well made up of equipment, fertilizers, raw materials, fuel, and complete factories, valued in the terms of international trade. Aid in the form of technical personnel and the training of cadres should also be considered as a contribution and counted as such. We are convinced that if the Secretary General of the United Nations, with assistance of the President of the General Assembly, with all the prestige and weight of this organization behind them, and further supported by the very outset by the backing of the developing countries, especially the Group of 77, could and would give that initiative, would call together the various factors we have mentioned to initiate the discussions in which there would be no room for the so-called North-South and East-West antagonisms, but in which all forces would be joined in a common undertaking, a common duty, and a common hope. This idea that we are now submitting to the General Assembly could then be crowned with success. This is not a project that would benefit only the developing nations. It would benefit all countries. As revolutionaries, we are not afraid of confrontation. We have placed our trust in history and in people. But as the spokesman and interpreter of the feelings of 95 nations, it is my duty here to struggle to achieve cooperation among peoples, a cooperation which, if attained on new and just bases, will benefit all the countries composing the international community and will be a blessing for world peace. Development in the short-term view may well be a task entailing apparent sacrifices and even donations which may seem irrecoverable. But the vast world now living in submerged backwardness with no purchasing power and with extremely limited consumer capacity will, with its development, add a flood of hundreds of consumers and producers to the international economy. And it is only in this way that the international economy can be rehabilitated and can help the developing countries to emerge from the crisis in which they are submerged. The history of international trade has shown that the development is the most dynamic factor in world trade. The major portion of trade today takes place among fully industrialized countries. We can assure you that as industrialization and progress spread throughout the world, so trade will also spread to the benefit of all. It is for this purpose that on the behalf of the developing countries, we advocate our cause and we ask you to support it. But it is not a gift that we seek from you. If we do not come up with effective solutions, we will be all victim equally to the catastrophe. Human rights are very often spoken of, but we must speak also of humanity's rights. Why should some people go barefoot that others may travel in expensive cars? Why should some live only 35 years that others may live 70? Why should some be miserably poor so that others may be exaggeratedly rich? I speak on behalf of the children of the world who do not even have a piece of bread. I speak on behalf of the sick who lack medicine. I speak to you on behalf of all those who have been denied the right to life and human dignity. Some countries are on the sea, some are not. Some have energy resources, others do not. Some possess abundant land on which to produce food, others do not. Some are so glutted with machinery and factories that even the air cannot be breathed because of their poisonous atmosphere, and others have only their emancipated arms with which they earn their daily bread. In short, some countries possess abundant resources, others have nothing. What is their fate? To starve? To be eternally poor? What good is civilization, then? Why, then, the consciousness of man? Why, then, the United Nations? Why, then, the world? You cannot speak of peace on behalf of tens of millions of human beings all over the world who are starving to death of dying and dying of curable diseases. You cannot speak of peace on behalf of 900 million illiterates. The exploitation of the poor countries by the rich must cease. I know that in many poor countries there are also exploiters and there are those who are exploited. I address myself to the rich, asking them to contribute. I address myself to the poor, asking them to distribute. Enough of words, now to deeds. Enough of abstractions. We now want concrete action. Enough of speaking about a speculative new international economic order which nobody understands. We must now speak of a real objective order which everybody understands. I have not come here as a prophet of the revolution. I have not come here to ask nor to wish that the world be violently convulsed. I have come to speak of peace and of cooperation among the peoples, and I have come to warn that if we do not peacefully and wisely solve and eliminate the presence of injustices and inequalities, the future will be apocalyptic. The clashing of weapons, the threatening language, and the overbearing behaviors in the international arena must cease. Enough of the illusion that the problems of the world can be solved by nuclear weapons. Bombs may kill the hungry, the sick, and the ignorant, but bombs cannot kill hunger, disease, and ignorance. Nor can bombs kill the righteous rebellion of the peoples. And in the Holocaust, the rich, who are the ones who have the most to lose in the world, will also die. Let us say farewell to arms, and let us, in a civilized manner, dedicate ourselves to the most pressing problems of our times. This is the responsibility. This is the most sacred duty of the statesman of all the world. Moreover, this is the basic premise for human survival. That is the end of that. That speech went from, looks like it started at 11:35 and it ended at 1:40. So probably a good thing that I didn't read all of it. But I did want to take a moment here and see if this part of the speech was understandable if I record it from my laptop's audio.
Distinguidos representantes, se habla con frecuencia de los derechos humanos, pero hay que hablar también de los derechos de la humanidad. ¿Por qué unos pueblos han de andar descalzos para que otros viajen en lujosos automóviles? ¿Por qué unos han de vivir 35 años para que otros vivan 70? ¿Por qué unos han de ser míseramente pobres para que otros sean exageradamente ricos? Hablo en nombre de los niños que en el mundo no tienen un pedazo de pan. Hablo en nombre de los enfermos que no tienen medicinas. Hablo en nombre de aquellos a los que se les ha negado el derecho a la vida y la dignidad humana. Unos países poseen, en fin, abundantes recursos. Otros no poseen nada. ¿Cuál es el destino de estos? Morirse de hambre. ser eternamente pobres. ¿Para qué sirve entonces la civilización? ¿Para qué sirve la conciencia del hombre? ¿Para qué sirven las Naciones Unidas? ¿Para qué sirve el mundo? No se puede hablar de paz en nombre de decenas de millones de seres humanos que mueren cada año de hambre o enfermedades curables en todo el mundo. No se puede hablar de paz en nombre de 900 millones de analfabetos. La explotación de los países pobres por los países ricos debe cesar. Sé que en muchos países pobres hay también explotadores y explotados. Me dirijo a las naciones ricas para que contribuyan. Me dirijo a los países pobres para que distribuyan. Basta ya de palabras. Hacen falta hechos. Basta ya de abstracciones. Hacen falta acciones concretas. Basta ya de hablar de un nuevo orden económico internacional especulativo que nadie entiende. Hay que hablar de un orden real y objetivo que todos comprendan. No he venido aquí como profeta de la revolución. No he venido a pedir o desear que el mundo se convulsione violentamente. Hemos venido a hablar de paz y colaboración entre los pueblos. Y hemos venido a advertir que si no resolvemos pacífica y sabiamente las injusticias y desigualdades actuales, el futuro será apocalíptico. El ruido de las armas, del lenguaje amenazante, de la prepotencia en la escena internacional debe cesar. Basta ya de la ilusión de que los problemas del mundo se pueden resolver con armas nucleares. Las bombas podrán matar a los hambrientos, a los enfermos, a los ignorantes, pero no pueden matar el hambre, las enfermedades, la ignorancia. No pueden tampoco matar la justa rebeldía de los pueblos. Y en el holocausto morirán también los ricos, que son los que más tienen que perder en este mundo. Digamos adiós a las armas y consagrémonos civilizadamente a los problemas más agobiantes de nuestra era. Esa es la responsabilidad y el deber más sagrado de todos los estadistas del mundo. Esa es, además, la premisa indispensable de la supervivencia humana. Muchas gracias.
All right. So if you didn't speak Spanish, that was the last section that I read. I'm also going to play this clip here just because I think it's pertinent. It's a clip from a speech given at the University of Buenos Aires in 2003 from Fidel. I will let him say his piece, and then I will pause intermittently to read the subtitles.
Bombas contra otros pueblos. Ni manda miles de aviones a bombardear ciudades.
He said, "Our country does not drop bombs on other people, nor does it send thousands of planes to bomb cities."
Ni manda miles de aviones a bombardear ciudades. Nuestro país no posee armas nucleares, ni armas químicas, ni armas biológicas.
Our country does not have nuclear weapons. Our country does not have chemical weapons. Our country does not have biological weapons.
La decena de miles de científicos con que cuenta nuestro país y sus médicos han sido educados en la idea de...
The tens of thousands of scientists and doctors in our country keenly understand that when one's calling is to save lives,
salvar vida estaría en absoluta contradicción.
It would be contradictory for a scientist or a doctor
con su concepción poner un científico o un médico a producir sustancias o bacterias o virus capaces de producir la muerte a otros seres.
To create substances like bacteria or viruses that are capable of causing human death.
Humanos. En nuestro país se hace investigaciones para curar enfermedades tan duras como la meningitis meningocócica, la hepatitis a través de...
Our labs have carried out research to treat diseases as severe as meningococcal meningitis, meningitis B, and hepatitis through vaccines.
Vacuna que... produce a través de técnicas de ingeniería genética
o by genetic engineering techniques or
algo de suma importancia, la búsqueda de vacunas o de fórmulas terapéuticas a través de la inmunología molecular. Perdóneme si he empleado esta palabra.
Most importantly, vaccines are therapeutic formulas rooted in molecular immunology. And then he says, forgive me the technical expression, in other words, by methods which directly attack the malignant cells.
Atacan directamente la célula maligna. Y lo mismo unas pueden prever y otras pueden incluso curar. Y avanzamos.
These cutting-edge methods serve to prevent as well as cure diseases.
Por esos caminos. Y ese es el orgullo de nuestros médicos. Y de
These techniques are the pride of our doctors and research centers.
Nuestro centro de investigación. Decenas de miles de médicos cubanos han prestado servicio internacionalista en lo que lugares más apartados e inhóspitos.
Tens of thousands of Cuban doctors have taken their services internationally into the most remote and inhospitable places.
Un día dije que nosotros no podíamos ni enviaríamos nunca o nunca realizaríamos ataques preventivos y sorpresivos.
One day I said that we could never and would never carry out surprise attacks against any lost corner of the world.
Contra ningún oscuro rincón del mundo. Pero que en cambio nuestro país era capaz de enviar los médicos que se necesiten a los más oscuros rincones del mundo.
But instead, our country will send the necessary doctors to those most lost corners of the world.
Médicos y no bombas.
Doctors, not bombs.
Médicos y no armas inteligentes de certera puntería.
Doctors, not smart weapons that hit their target.
Porque al fin y al cabo, un arma que mata,
a weapon that kills by treachery,
traicioneramente, no es absolutamente,
is absolutely not,
un arma inteligente,
an intelligent weapon. It. So there's many more speeches that I would love to show you folks. Maybe we'll do a little series. But the reason why I wanted to bring up this particular speech and subsequent speech, Doctors Not Bombs, is because in my experience, right, I have learned a lot in the last few years about the difference between human rights and humanity's rights, as Fidel put it. And what I mean is that there is a huge difference, what we might call a contradiction, between what is said to be the right of humans and what is the necessary need for survival of the human race. We are told that internationally, organizations like the United Nations, which Fidel and other revolutionaries have used in the past as a platform or essentially a balcony by which to speak from. Not expecting, as Fidel said, the revolutionary ideas to be the most primary or forthright in the minds of the statesmen and the heads of government who take up positions in the United Nations. As he says, he is not there to condemn the actions with inexhaustible insults, nor is he there to speak solely on behalf of the Cuban people, but that he is there not only as a representative of the poor people of the world, but also of the non-aligned movement of 95 countries, which make up the majority of the world's population. Still to this day, even though the non-aligned movement has since gone out of existence to some extent. Although I will say also here that it is being revived through other mechanisms. And so I've learned, right, through especially the relationships I've built with people who have gone to Cuba, people who are from Cuba. I was very lucky to hear a speech from the foreign minister of Cuba last summer, at the historic People's Church, Darn. It's in Harlem. Might actually be the People's Church, but apologies if I'm incorrect. It was an event that the People's Forum put on U.S. democracy, or democracy without the United States, right? And not only this, but also the human relationships I've been able to build in my own life at work, with family members, in school. It is very clear that, for example, the rights to things like freedom of the press, freedom of private property, freedom of speech. These things, for billions across the world, fall on, empty promises. I don't know how to turn that phrase, but essentially I'm meaning that these rights, these quote human liberties, mean nothing in the face of the lack of the needs of human beings to survival, to self-determination, to literacy, to education, to consciousness, to self-government, and to liberation, to an end of colonialism, imperialism, and neocolonialism, an end of the philosophy of plunder, an end to all wars, all coercive measures, all collusion, all corruption, and especially an end to this contradictory method of implementing control through a discussion of supposed human rights. Finishing up here, as I could go forever, we know that the world today is filled with poor, hungry, homeless, destitute, refugee, nomadic types who are forced out of their homes, out of their land, who are suffering from colonial repression, from neo-colonial regimes, who are continuing to struggle against apartheid, against racial discrimination, against sexual and gender-based oppression, against the violence and reactionism that is on the rise, against fascism, against imperialism. And we know that these people are the ones who have clear in their mind and in their hearts their objective for what real freedom and liberty can look like against the supposed ideas of those who came before, those who have used these ideas to manipulate, maneuver, to overthrow, oppress, and conquer, colonialize, ensnare, enslave, and exploit the people's liberation movements, the nation states, the governments, the economies, the resources, the labor forces, the land, the liberties, equalities, and justice that supposedly were coming in through quote-unquote European civilization on slave ships with guns in arm, with cannons, with military settlements, with colonial settlements, with rape, with torture, with enslavement, with exploitation. All of this is the supposed human rights, the supposed democracy, the supposed civilization and freedom that the poor people of the world are told they are to accept. And yet we know that this is completely a sham. We know that humanity is in need of food, in need of medicine, in need of education, and especially in need of political power, economic control, new social relations, and a new situation. And as Fidel speaks about, the majority of the world, deep down in their heart, in their movements, in their countrysides, in their grassroots, and in their souls, know that this is the rhythm, the movement, the move to get on. And so that is what they're doing, and that is what we need to do. definitely want to hear from all you what you think. Please reach out, get a hold of me if you'd like. Looking forward to talking again soon. Peace, y'all.